All right.
It's great. If we could sync up our drinking to all happen at exactly the same time, that would be great.
But can we sync up me falling on the ground with the rest of you after an hour?
This episode of the PC Perspective Podcast is brought to you by MSI and their new Sandy Bridge Ready motherboards.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the PC Perspective Podcast. This is episode 188, recorded on February 8th, 2012. I'm Ryan Schrout.
I'm Josh Walrath.
And I'm Alan Melvin Tunnell.
And we don't have Jeremy with us today. We've actually substituted Canadians. We've gotten rid of Jeremy just for this week, I think, and we have replaced him with a separate Canadian, but also in the same part of the country, David Hewlett, who you guys might know of Stargate Atlantis fame, is joining us. He's actually a pretty big tech nerd as well, right?
I would like to be much bigger a nerd than I am, but yes, I do fancy myself a bit of a tech nerd. Yes. And thank you.
Who wants to introduce?
Go ahead, Josh.
You know, David is working on a couple of big projects right now. The biggest of which is he's working with his sister, Kate Hewlett. She actually starred, but guested with him on Stargate Atlantis as his sister, Dr. Rodney McKay. But anyway, they're working together on a new web series called Assassinate. I'm sure that you'll want to see this. It's rather amusing. Some clever dialogue. And you get to see David in eyeliner.
A lot of it.
For those of you who survived the 80s, they're already quite familiar with that. But yes, it's nice to return to it.
What's the address people can go to find Assassinate? What's the easiest way for them to find that?
YouTube. We're on YouTube, and it's the Horrid channel, as we call it, which is it's Horrid with a zero instead of an O, because I wanted to make it as difficult as possible for people to find it, basically, by the looks of it.
All right. So I guess give me a little bit of background on, you know, people know you from your TV shows and that kind of stuff, but what brought you to PC Perspective? Why do you watch us? Of all the things you could be watching, why do you watch us?
I was a slightly a late start on the nerd for in my perspective, but looking back, it was actually sort of an early adopter. But I got into the Commodore 64 way back when, and from there got into building 8088s and all the old PCs and XTs, which I just loved and spent far too much time and money, and basically continued doing that all the way through till the I guess it was the 486 was the last one I would have built.
Because system, you really know. Like IRQs, don't you?
Yes, exactly.
And adjusting them. That's the greatest thing ever.
So
let me add this
fun.
Sound card. It's going to take me 3 days to do it, but damn it. That ape sound is worth it.
Well, and the hardware was, and it's still the case to some extent, the hardware was always ahead of the software. It was just always, there was never the software to run these fantastic new things that you just stuck in your system either, so...
Nothing has really changed.
It killed me how long it took PCs to catch up to how good the Commodore 64 sound was of all things.
My God, even the graphics were amazing. I mean, the games on that were fantastic.
Yeah,
it's funny. I feel like the kid in this conversation because I never had a Commodore 64, and I got to tell you, when I came into PCs, IRQs were just easily managed. Sorry, guys.
Yeah,
I missed all of the pain.
You were lucky. You, frankly.
No. Screw you. I cut my teeth on a TRS-80, the Radio Shack Trash 80.
Trash 80. Yeah.
And I was able to record on a cassette tape my programs.
That's right. Well, I remember this is what happens when you get old nerds together, but I remember having to split up my schoolwork, which they ended up not accepting because it was typed out, as they put it. Instead of handwritten, but I had to split my work files into multiple files because you couldn't actually save one whole document in one file. So you'd have like your essay, your 10-page essay would be 10 little Bank Street Writer files on the Commodore 64.
Oh, Bank Street Writer
on a tape deck. Remember that? Yeah, Blast from the Past.
Yes,
I do not. Sorry,
my family could never afford a Commodore 64. That's why we went to Radio Shack. Screw y'all,
Ryan. Get off our
line.
I think my first computer was a 486, actually.
Jesus.
Anyhow.
Sorry. Sorry. Yeah. So we all have moved. Yeah. We've all moved past 486 now. What kind of gadgets and technology are you using today, though? What do you think is pervasive in your life? What do you can't live without?
The MacBook Air. I mean, I just because of its weight. I mean, it's such a dream for me, for a guy who's grown up having, you know, these big clunky old computers all my life. I mean, I bought like one of the first laptops available. Yeah, exactly. Just light, easy to use. I do a lot of running around, so I like to be able to bring the computer with me. And after a while, you just get sick and tired of bringing these giant things around. So, the MacBook Air is fantastic. Unfortunately, it's the older one. I want to get the new one with the Thunderbolt because I hate not having that flexibility. Like, I like having drives that I can add that I can actually do.
We saw a lot of interesting Thunderbolt accessories at CES this year, actually, including like external graphics adapters and that kind of stuff, which would in theory allow people with ultra thin notebooks like that be able to expand kind of the technology and what connectivity they have and even their graphics horsepower and that kind of stuff.
But
did you do any kind of
gaming
console or PC?
Basically, as soon as I had a son, I bought the PS3 and the Xbox as an excuse because I wanted him to, you know, be able to work on both platforms. I'm one of those shameful nerds who would absolutely love to do gaming, but two things stop me. One is I would never get anything done, so I banned myself from them, and also I get motion sickness on them, first-person shooters.
I have several friends that have that. And I know, Josh, you just recently picked up a console as well and you used your children as an excuse too. Is that correct?
Totally.
Exactly. And my wife bought it hook, line, and sinker.
They do. Just mention the word educational and computer and they're all for it.
Get a Kinect. It's physical activity. There's all kinds of things you can work
on. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Except I've discovered now, my son and I have discovered that it actually does what it's told now. It's voice activated, so we stop waving our arms around a lot.
Nice.
You know, the bad thing about that is for the excuse, I brought home the Kinect exercise for my wife, and she turned around and just simply said, "Are you calling me fat?"
Oh, good one.
So anyway, it's still sitting on the shelf.
I want to get the UFC one, the UFC training. That looked like fun, where you just, you know, kick the crap out of people, and that's exercise.
That's what I do.
Go Mike Tyson.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we'll start out here talking about, we mentioned the Assassinate stuff. You are, you know, you come from a TV and film background. What are your kind of goals here? You know, Josh mentions one of the topics that you kind of wanted to discuss was this kind of idea of digital distribution and how you view technology changing it. We deal with a lot of that here, obviously, both in the fact that we are able to distribute an audio and video podcast to tens of thousands of people at almost no cost to us. And
it's unheard of. It's unheard of 10 years ago. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, it's a dream for me because I'm a huge control freak. I mean, like what Leo and the guys have done with Twit is so inspiring to me because that's the hope for any sort of creative soul with a business, you know, with any kind of a business mind as well. You know, the idea of being able to do what you want to do and distribute it yourself, you know, because for so long, the distribution channels have been completely controlled, you know, by sort of other companies. So
how have you seen this technology change? Obviously, you kind of went into your own kind of filmmaking with A Dog's Breakfast. Have things progressed even since then? I guess that came out in 2006, right? So,
yeah, it's funny. I mean, we would have done a lot of things differently now. I mean, I'd originally wanted to do full self-distribution on that film, and I wanted to release it on the internet, and I wanted to do the whole, you know, we had an issue with we ended up actually selling it to MGM because it just made more sense. They had a much wider market to get the movie out, and more people were going to see it that way, apparently. So I'm not sure that's entirely true, but that was the idea anyway. But, you know, one of the interesting things that happened with Dog's Breakfast was it was on the torrents very quickly. Within a week of the film coming out in wherever it came out first, I'm not sure where it was. It was on the torrents, and I went on and I looked and saw that there'd been, you know, a lot of downloads, and contacted MGM and said, look, you know, just so you know, I was sort of saying, look how popular the film is. And they freaked out and started sending legal, you know, cease and desist type things. But
you know, that's lies, David. You talked to them and said, sue these assholes into the ground.
Well,
stop
no,
burning my money. They're stealing my pennies.
If I thought they were, I would totally be I'm all about that. Like, you know, if it's I'm losing money, then I've got an issue with it. But my thought was just, people will watch something for free that they won't pay for. You know, I mean, I will watch things that of a quality that, you know, that I can be convinced to see simply because I don't have to pay for it. So I assumed that most of the people who saw that, they wouldn't have paid for it. So they've seen it and they wouldn't have if it hadn't been free. I actually tried to persuade MGM to put an ad on it. Like, basically just put a little ad at the end that said, if you enjoyed this or thanks for watching, you know, this was a little labor of love with a bunch of people and friends and, you know, go buy a copy or something like that. Or even advertise Stargate or something. I mean, just use it to our advantage as opposed to just trying to stop it. And I think that that's something that's beginning to be explored now. And I think is a much more sort of intelligent approach to it because, you know, you just can't stop this stuff from happening. So I like the clips. Me cleaning. And this is what I resorted to because people weren't buying the movie. I now have to actually wash tubs.
Clean some. Yeah, it just seems that it would make more sense to have a lower price but better distribution. You'd still make more money with the kind of connectivity that we have with billions of people around the world.
That's exactly the key. I think people want to stop piracy. You want to stop piracy, you make things available to everybody at a price that people are willing to pay. And if that means changing the way movies are made, and I think it does, I think it means that movies are going to have to be a lot cheaper. And I think that means that, you know, studios, distributors, unions, performers, everyone has got to start sort of, taking risks instead of getting the money up front. I mean, I watched a fantastic documentary series, like 7 hours. I nerded out of 7 hours of this history of Hollywood. And it started with people, with Nickelodeons, with 5 cents. You know, you paid 5 cents, you went in and you watched like 2 minutes of you know, a couple kissing or something. I mean, basically porn. But, you know, these studios made millions and millions of dollars, a nickel a piece, nickel at a time. And, they were taking risks. They'd make it on their own dime. And if it made money, then they made money. So, you know, the actors the same way. I mean, I think that nowadays people get these huge deals with money up front and whether the movie makes money or not. And what needs to happen is, you know, you make your movie and if the money comes in, then you get a bit of it then. So
accountability, percentage based stuff. Yeah. It'd be interesting. Let's go through a couple of our tech stories here. Absolutely, David. Feel Please. Free to chime in if you've got any thoughts, ideas, complaints about stuff that's going on. Not a whole lot happened this week in terms of big launches, reviews, and news, that type of thing. One thing that I attended last week, actually right after the recording of last week's podcast, was the AMD Analyst Day out in Sunnyvale, California.
The Analyst Day?
They gather a ton of people that control billions and billions of dollars in mutual funds and try to convince them that AMD is a good investment. And it's been pretty hard to do that over the last several years. But this one was kind of interesting because they have a very new team, new CEO, new CTO, new executives all around. They fired, let go, whatever you want to call it, culled a large percentage of kind of their press media facing marketing teams. So they had a lot to answer for and they had a lot to try to prove. What was interesting that, you know, the main takeaway from the whole event was that it's kind of analogous to a lot of things in the technology world. Now AMD is going to try to become a more modular company. So when we talk about on this podcast a lot, modularity in processor and GPU design, being able to, for instance, if you're AMD, you have a 2000 shader GPU, you want to be able to make an 1800 shader and a 1600 shader and a 1500 shader unit to be able to sell at different prices. You want to be able to make that easy so that there's not a lot of work and cost involved in coming up with these new products. Well, AMD is taking that same kind of approach and attempting to apply it to the entire company. They want everything they do to be modular. The CPU designs, the GPU designs, they actually are going to start allowing third-party IP to be integrated with their SoCs, which is kind of a pretty big deal. There was
pretty
no...
smart.
Yeah, what everybody thinks is going to happen is that you're going to see an SoC with ARM processing cores and AMD graphics technology in a very similar light to what NVIDIA has with Tegra, which is ARM processing cores and NVIDIA-based graphics technology. They didn't announce that, but they very much alluded to it. They kept saying that they, as a company, they were going to be ambidextrous. They were going to be... able to switch. They weren't tied to any single architecture, which their only architecture they really have now is x86. So it kind of, it's very easy to see what they were kind of leaning towards there. Josh, I don't know kind of what you thought about this idea. So it seems pretty obvious now that what they're going to do is they're giving up high performance processor race with Intel. They obviously don't say it that way, but they're giving it up in hopes of building a more modular company as a whole. You know, they even gave us some specifics like, yes, they know they're leaving 3-5% performance on processing cores and GPU cores by designing them to be very modular. So they realize they're going to give up a little bit. They seemed appeased, at least with the performance gap between their processors and Intel processors at this point, saying that we are going to make money now by building these SoCs for custom parts. You know, if a certain server customer wants 100,000 processors that do this one specific thing very well, we can build a part. If they have custom IP that they want to integrate into that, we can work with them too if it's a big enough order, that kind of thing. So what are your kind of thoughts on that change in direction? And, you know, from an enthusiast standpoint, are we done seeing high-end processors past the roadmap that we've already know and that it is kind of baked out inside AMD?
Boy, that's that's a tough question, but there are things that we do know from their roadmap that they are somewhat abandoning the high end of the desktop CPU. That's just going to be Intel's, and they don't really care because it's only a couple of percent of their market and what they offer. Instead, they think that really the crown jewel of their company is the GPU technology. Sure, the CPU works great. They've got a good design. It's the second best design in the world, but it's just not able to get them over the hump when dealing with Intel. And so they're kind of taking a flanking maneuver with Intel and to see, hopefully, that they can gain more market share and to be able to bring forward some of their ideas on high-performance computing and to actually get them implemented and to become a more profitable company. And so, essentially, we are seeing the AM3 Plus socket that was the high-end offering of AMD for the CPUs. That's not going to change very much in the next year, but what we will see is a big change in their APUs, their accelerated processing units, which combine CPU and GPU. And they're recalling. I mean, they are no longer calling this the Fusion architecture, but now it's the HSA or the Heterogeneous System Architecture. Basically, they want to more tightly combine the graphics and the processing power of their products, and to make, you know, even though the sum of the parts or, you know, the individual parts are not that great, but the sum of them as a whole is going to be better than what they hope that Intel is going to be able to offer. And if you look at what Intel has done with, say, like Sandy Bridge and now the upcoming Ivy Bridge, they've already integrated the CPU and the GPU. And in some of these products, the GPU is almost a throw-off because Intel does not, I mean, it does, but it really doesn't support OpenCL and some of these, you know, more GPU type applications, because what they're trying to sell is CPUs and more CPU power. And so AMD is saying, hey, we've got this huge chunk of silicon that's got all of this processing capability, this huge amount of floating point math that it can do. Why don't we utilize this, change the software environment so we can actually combine a lot of the processes and get a much faster product out, because we have almost as good a CPU, but we've got almost a year or two ahead of graphics technology that Intel does not even offer. And so I think we're going to see AM3 just kind of kick the bucket after about a year. They're going to release another high-end CPU part based on the pile driver core, and that'll kind of be their last offering there. And then after that, I think that they're going to try to move everybody over to APUs. And so hopefully, at least from AMD's perspective, HSA and this, more fused system architecture, which can utilize both CPUs and GPUs in a heterogeneous environment. Boy, I should really work for AMD. But anyway, I mean, if they achieve this and, get Microsoft behind it, get all these other software developers, which they have started to go over to. I mean, NVIDIA's paid a lot of money to other developers Adobe has some special things with Photoshop that will rely upon the GPU to do some filters and other stuff like that. If they can get that more throughout the industry, we will see AMD actually taking a lead in terms of overall performance. But it's going to be a big jump to get the software developers on there. But I think that they are making their team more lean. That's a positive thing. They just let somebody else go. They canned him and sent him packing. And you kind of look at the past 5 years and you wonder if some of these guys have not become more entrenched than they really should have been, and the company was not moving forward because there was not the enthusiasm, the power, the drive to go to these different and new and interesting markets that are really opening up for us. So, I think I was a little fearful at first. I thought they let a few two important people go. But when you start looking at the whole, it is a lean organization. Their business really has been taken care of. I mean, this past year, they've actually made themselves somewhat solvent, which is pretty positive as compared to a couple of years ago when they're just losing billions a quarter. So
where's their money coming from? What are their sales? Like what sales are doing well for them? Is it the graphics?
Well, their CPUs are still the highest selling product of the company. I think it's out of 1.6 billion a quarter, about 1 billion of that is CPU, about 400 million is pure GPU stuff. And then the next, couple hundred million are chipsets, some other, small chips that they make and just some odds and ends and licensing. But other than that, CPUs are still the main driver of the company, and what they're doing here is, boy, it's so complex to say in just a couple of minutes, because there's so many layers of the CPU business that we are not even covering. We're not talking about process technology. We're not talking about fab space, wafer starts, all of that stuff that really does make a difference to these companies, not to mention the OEMs and ODMs and everybody who buys these chips like 6 months in advance of when they're due to be released. So, I think that AMD has turned over a new leaf. It's going to be rough. They're going to really have to leverage some of their partnerships with software people to really get this idea going. But, of course, which is kind of interesting, their primary partner in all this is actually NVIDIA, because they're a company who's trying to push GPU and more of the heterogeneous computing far more so than Intel. And so hopefully AMD and NVIDIA can work this out so they can kind of offset Intel, who literally is the 800-pound gorilla in the room who can just drive everybody under the table with their process technology, their fabrication abilities, and just, the pure manufacturing strength of their products and their design team. So, have I gone off tangent enough for all of you?
No, I think it's good. It's really dramatic. I think it will only be more apparent how dramatic their shift is over the course of 2012. I think next year's Analyst Day, the company will even look more different than it does today. By quite a bit. I think we'll see AMD will be a completely different company, and we may see it in new in interesting places, tablets and phones and that kind of market that we maybe would have never thought we would have seen it in.
They've got to start stepping up on that, don't they? I mean, they've got it. It's just that's such a huge, huge market. I mean, the desktop seems almost, I mean, you know, it's almost secondary now, doesn't it? I mean, certainly in
the, it is. It's secondary, except, you know, they mentioned it at the analyst day that the big, you know, they're only expecting like less than 1% growth in North America, but they're expecting almost 10% growth in Asia and India. And so those are the markets they need to address. And those markets are much more concerned about power consumption as they are performance.
Right.
And so you'll see a lot of these different mixes of the company and being able to meet deadlines and directly address OEM requirements and requests in a much more flexible way than we have with AMD in the past.
But for AMD to take advantage of this, though, is it reliant on the software? I mean, without the software, this whole thing falls apart, doesn't it? I mean, there's no...
Yeah, so their advantage is their GPU cores. That is more than obvious to them. And what's unfortunate for AMD is that in order for these big software transitions to take place in the industry, it almost always depends on Intel to... saying NVIDIA being one of AMD's biggest partners in this, it's ironic in that they battle on so many fronts. But on this side, they're both kind of trying to get to that goal before Intel can get there. But it tends to be, you know, AMD was the first one out with a 64-bit processor. They were the first ones to really kind of push that. And the operating system was out, but nobody really started to adopt 64-bit OS really until Intel could support it as well, because they're 80% of the market or more. And OEMs and software vendors aren't going to spend a whole bunch of time unless they know that the adoption and that their potential for sales are at a certain level. So, you know, the performance advantages have to be really, really, really strong in order for these software guys to take that leap and leave this strong majority behind them. So
they're an amazing company, though. They're amazing companies. I remember, you know, way back when in my days of building systems that they showed up and everyone was like, well, you know, how could you possibly compete with Intel? I mean, Intel just had the market and they were this scrappy little startup, I believe, if I got it right. But,
they had a 486, 50 megahertz part well before, you know, while Intel had a 333 megahertz, and Intel went to 66 megahertz and AMD went to 80.
Was that when they came into play? When did they sort of show up? Was it the 386s that they sort of started doing the quote-unquote clones of?
Yeah, I mean, I think Intel actually licensed out designs to AMD to fabricate because Intel just couldn't make enough of them. And the next thing you know, they come out with their own designs or, you know, kind of own designs. And, you know, they competed very well.
I remember agonizing over that, whether I should go to an AMD because it was slightly cheaper and faster, but it wasn't it wasn't the sort of the standard at the time. So I can't remember what I did. I think I went with Intel. I'm such a wimp.
Yeah, I mean, and yeah, they, as a company, they've progressed. They had the Athlon, and they were in the lead for a while. They never gained as much market share as I felt like they should have, It's unfortunate. A couple other quick hardware things to talk about. This little video card was actually kind of interesting. It's small in terms of discrete graphics cards, especially when you talk about discrete graphics cards that we review here at PC Perspective. This is the Galaxy GeForce MDT GT520. The GT520 is not a very powerful GPU. Don't expect to do a whole lot of gaming on this. But what's interesting about this card is the MDT part of it. It actually has both of the display outputs out of the NVIDIA GPU go into IDT chips. I can't remember the model number right now, but the IDT chips then take that available bandwidth and split it off into two additional displays. So what you get in the box are a couple of these. You get two of these, which are actually splitters that take you from a single connection to dual DVI connections. So out of the back of this card, you actually get four graphics cards that can run DVI. You don't have to have DisplayPort. You don't have to have any kind of active adapters. These come straight out of the box like this. You can run four displays up to 12.
Those are the special connectors with the four rows of pins in them, right?
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know if I can get these close up to the camera that'll actually focus. Yeah, there you go. It's not a DVI connection, so don't plug your to plug a regular DVI monitor into that.
It won't fit either. It won't even work.
Oh, okay. But you can see here, so on the adapter, you can see all of the pins, maybe, kind of. But on this side, you'll see the standard kind of DVI connections that you're used to seeing. So this lets you get four displays out of a $120 video card, which is actually really nice. And you don't have to have any adapters and that kind of stuff. And this is more beneficial, I think, for people that do content creation, people that are, day traders, people who work with enormous Excel sheets and need to have multiple things open at once, content creators, like I said. But gaming, it does okay, and you can do two display gaming, which is really only useful if you're doing real-time strategy games, StarCraft, something like that. You don't want to play a first-person shooter on two monitors where your aiming reticle is right down the middle. That's obviously not a good mix. But Galaxy's done a pretty good job with this MDT technology, multi-display technology, trying to bring multi-display configurations to NVIDIA graphics cards when so far they've been pretty much exclusive to single AMD cards in single GPU configurations. So mm-hmm. Interesting.
Those are actually those same cables that you used to apply to some of the back then ATI cards.
Yeah, and I think they've been around in the professional series cards. I think old Dell machines used to ship with them as well, some kind of add-in card that was a big deal to get two displays out of a single card, and that's how they did that. But, it's cheap enough now that Galaxy was able to integrate two of those chips on a single card, and, the dongle's on it for about $120 online and at Best Buy and those kinds of places. So pretty interesting technology. If you do a lot of content creation, we can't stress the importance of multi-displays enough. Which, again, as we were mentioning earlier, David, with things like Thunderbolt, that is, one of the downsides to these kind of small, thin and lights is that screen real estate. And Thunderbolt will hopefully help alleviate some of those problems. But until then, people who still do most of their work on desktops will find a lot of that kind of stuff interesting, I think.
Yeah, so, David, you always go to the desktop.
Alan. We just had an SSD launch. We did have an SSD launch this week. That's right. I forgot. We did have the Intel 520. This is kind of this is the Cherryville architecture, right? And kind of not a big surprise. Turns out it doesn't use an Intel controller after all.
No, it wasn't a big surprise there. We've heard rumors for a while now that they're probably going to go with SandForce, that their own 6 gigabit per second serial ATA solution is just not there yet. I do have it on good authority that there is one that's going to come eventually from Intel. I would imagine the same, 10-channel style controller that came out way back when in the X25M and years back. However, the 510 series that came out about 6 months back, I believe, was their first 6 gigabit per second serial ATA part, and that was Marvell. That chip, you could only push it so far, but I will say that Intel made that firmware that controlled that chip work better than I had seen anyone else make a comparable, same Marvell chip in whatever their solution was work, right? So Intel just has this knack, like their team, they really know how this flash memory works. They really know how to make, they can pretty much take any given set of hardware that's meant to control it and just make it work better, right? They just take, okay, you guys have made this, congratulations. Now let us go in the back room with this software and we'll work some voodoo on it and it'll come out looking better.
It's called like 60,000 employees.
Yeah, basically. and then the guys walk down the hallways in slow motion and, real smart things happen, just like on the Intel commercials. However, I wasn't sure what they were going to be able to pull off with this because the 520 series uses SandForce and there's already companies out there that have been tweaking that firmware for quite some time. Specifically, OCZ comes to mind. Right out of the gate when the Vertex 3 came out and then the Agility 3, those drives had firmwares that were tweaked and they just handled... here's the way to tell the difference between these SandForce chips. Most of the stuff that has to do with the specification is even across the board. Right, the chip came from SandForce. It did pretty well on like your maximum throughput. Basically, anytime you're reading or writing big files to this SSD, or just the generic IOs per second test, which is where you just do a simple random access, 4 kilobyte. How many 4 kilobyte random writes can you do to this thing per second? And then you just get a number for that, right? So there's your read spec, your write spec, and your IOs per second spec. Pretty much all the companies, those specs are roughly the same. The key that we found is that when we do one of our benchmarks, which we refuse to let go of, is like a mixed mode kind of test. We use Intel's, well, what used to be Intel's, now it's open source, Iometer. And we have some custom profiles that we plug into that thing. And it's basically a scriptable tool that hits the drive with a certain type of workload. And we're not hitting it with just one thing at a time, like reading or writing or trying to do a specific type of random access. Sure. We're hitting it with like a mixed workload. Like the system is actually working hard and doing a bunch of things at the same time, which guess what? Last time I checked, computers are multi-threaded. They do multiple things at the same time, right? So this is sort of like a real true test of these things. And this is where the firmware differences show big time. So it turns out anything that's like any company that's using the standard SandForce firmware, it almost sticks out like a sore thumb on this test. That line will be one of the bottom results on the test if it's stock SandForce, you know, software driven controller. Then OCZ does a little bit better, actually a lot better, with their tweaked firmwares. The Agility does, you know, a pretty good chunk better. Then the Vertex, which is synchronous flash versus asynchronous flash, does even a little bit better on top of that. However, Intel once again pulled a bunch of tricks out of their sleeve, or whatever you want to call it. They made this thing go even that much faster. Now, granted, it wasn't this huge gain, but it was like 5 to 10% across the board. Gain over the fastest competition, which in this case is the OCZ Vertex 3 drive. So it was good to see that. That's one part of the equation here. The other part of the equation is this drive's coming from Intel. So they can cherry pick what flash memory they stick in the drive. So the flash memory that goes into these drives is, first of all, it's IMFT flash. It's from Intel's own fab. On top of that, it's like their top binned flash. Like they flat out, they just come out and said this on the press to everybody. They were just like, look, it's the best stuff. Everybody else that's buying it from us, they're not getting the stuff that's as good as what we put in this drive. And because of that, they're able to make the spec for their warranty is 5 years versus what most every other SandForce on the market is 3 years. So that's sort of a pretty big deal all around. They have the best performing SandForce chip. Granted, there are some other controllers out there that are a little bit faster in some areas, depending on what you're measuring for. But on average, on like, you know, almost everything that really counts, this is the fastest Serial ATA 6 gigabit drive we've tested. So definitely a good deal there. The big negative, or the big catch, because there's always going to be a catch, introductory pricing seemed a little bit high. That was the deal. We're hoping that's going to come down. All we had to go off of was just MSRPs. Those are just known for being higher. Typically, you know, they usually come down with the market. But there you go. That's it for the SandForce.
It's interesting to see Intel do this. I don't think anybody was surprised. We'd heard those rumors for a long time. But with so much competition in that area, I'm not sure it's a slam dunk for anybody at this point.
Right. I would have called it a slam dunk if they were anywhere close to the cost per gig of at least some of the competition. Then I would have said, yep, that's it. Shoe in.
Are these available and for sale yet, or are they coming soon type of thing?
I think if we Google around right now, we might find some, but they weren't.
So I just wondered what the street price would be versus maybe what the prices up there that they would give us, you know, that type of thing. If that's different, then, you know, more power to them. But
actually, yeah, but David I've got to make fun of Alan because he paid $600 for an 80 gig drive.
That's true. Where is that thing?
So the Intel 520 120 gig is $229 on Newegg.
Here you go. There it is, right there. I paid $650 for this thing, like several years back, and it was only an 80 gigabyte drive.
Wow. Yeah, that stuff has just plummeted in price, hasn't it?
Way, way cheaper. Yeah. David, you actually have like an SSD in your MacBook Air, right?
Yeah, yeah. I paid a little extra for it at the time because I'm so enamored with that idea. It just seems it's a bit like driving around in, you know, vehicles that burn old dinosaurs. It just felt that the hard drives were it just seemed silly, you know, like a spinning wheel and magnets and all that stuff. Although I know you got freaking lasers, that's coming up. But still, SSDs just seemed to make so much more sense, and it really does make a difference. I mean,
any person that uses them side by side immediately knows the benefit of solid state. I mean, it is incredibly apparent. Even people that don't think that they're computer, you know, enthusiasts or whatever, and they don't think they'd be able to tell a difference from that kind of stuff, and they haven't been able to tell a difference through processor upgrades or video card upgrades, you show them their laptop starting in 14 seconds instead of 50 seconds and all their applications loading almost instantly, and all of a sudden you get people's attention. And I think that's why there has been so much discussion both on all kinds of other websites as well as PC Perspective about SSDs, because they are that kind of, they have been over the last couple of years, that kind of world-changing, class-changing product, for sure.
Corporate speak, like saying, it's a paradigm shift.
Synergy.
We're using the synergy. Synergy.
You know, Intel had this press, I think we mentioned it a week or two ago on the podcast, but Intel had, when they did this big press thing with all the press people about this specific drive coming out, they said they're seriously getting behind the solid state drive thing. Their entire enterprise, the entire Intel corporate enterprise, like all the seats, all the workstations people are working at, laptops, any of that, they're all on SSDs.
Well, they also use that as a major troubleshooting thing too, right?
That's half our company that's just went down because of your goddamn firmware update.
But also power as well. The SSD just makes sense for power in these things. I mean, you know, the hard drives are just this giant thing that just suck up so much power.
And the whole heat dropping, you know, you drop it and you lost like half your stuff because your quote unquote record just skipped.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It does feel very 80s. The whole hard drive thing feels very 1980s to me.
Well, I tell you as soon as these SSD vendors can get me 9 terabytes of storage that I need for all my video work for under, I don't know, $5,000, I'll make it easy for them, under $5,000, then I'll be sold. But until then, most people got to have both, right?
I love my SSD, but I've still got a giant RAID stuck under the
you're working with video stuff, right? I mean, there's a place for both, and maybe eventually we'll just be on solid state. I don't know. Maybe we'll go back to tape drives if they get fast again. Who knows? You know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reliability thing that everyone talks about, but I just can't imagine anything more unreliable than spinning discs. Like, I just say, like, oh, the SSDs, you know, they don't know how long they're going to last for. It's like, yeah, but I know how long the hard drives last for. It's about 2 years, and then I end up having to toast it because I've dropped it or it's just died on me.
I mean, pretty much that's why RAID was invented, was, oh, man, these drives kind of suck. How do I not lose all my data all the time? I know, I'll buy two, and bravo.
Although I've had problems with RAID as well. I've had so many issues, you know.
Ryan's had RAIDs crash on him, and he's had to send me the discs, and I've had to do crazy recoveries and stuff.
Right, well, I'll send you a few next time.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You're on.
I think I lost 2 years worth of stuff.
So wait a minute. You mean to tell me, David, you're going to give me one of those Stargate moments where at the last second I'm going to crack the crypto and it's going to here's your data. I found it for you.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. That. Right.
That would be so amazing.
No, because, you know, we don't do montages on this goddamn show. So
you guys need montages. Montages solve a multitude of sins.
I just can't help but sing that song after I watched Team America. Yeah. Everybody, every movie needs the montage. I mean, why move on?
Or slow motion. That's the other thing.
Always we do that, but it's always mostly unintentional due to Skype lag.
Yeah.
So
yes, we that's true. It is true. Yes.
Let's take we'll take a quick break here. Thank today's podcast sponsor. When we come back, we got a lot more topics to run through as well, including white space wireless discussion, hard drives and lasers and how those combine in some way. And apparently somebody in academia did something interesting with processors. So we'll talk about that in just a second.
MSI's new Z68 G3 series motherboards bring the most complete Sandy Bridge platform on the market by utilizing the Intel Z68 chipset, which adds great features like Virtue GPU switching and SSD caching. Exclusive features from MSI include the certified military class 2 components with a 5-year warranty, one-touch overclocking with OCGNI 2, and introducing the revamped UEFI interface, ClickBIOS 2, for easy configuration on your PC. The Z68 G3 series even future-proofs itself with PCI Express Gen 3 support. Look for the upcoming review on PC Perspective, or go to us.msi.com for more information on this amazing product.
All right, welcome back. So, Josh, you were going to take away here this topic on like kind of white space wireless.
Well, you know, Alan, you were a nuclear engineer, correct?
I have been known to control some reactor plants on submarines in my time.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever gone into ham radio?
It is very fun to say that. So part of my rating for what I did before for Navy stuff was electronics technician as well, and we had to learn a bunch of communications and radio stuff back then because for some reason the Navy just taught them that stuff too. So that was cool. I got to learn that stuff. I know David brought up this topic before we sort of line this podcast up about white space. You have interests in white space stuffs?
Yeah.
You would like to
talk
about?
I was just intrigued because it sounded so low tech and yet it's so promising, if that makes sense. I mean, you know, again, this sort of ties into the distribution model thing for me where I always feel like I've always just been a little bit behind the next, you know, the next big thing. And, you know, I remember when people were setting up modems to do internet access and then the wireless came along and this just seems like the next great leap for this. The idea of having very fast local sort of coverage for wireless.
Right.
I mean, I don't know an awful lot about it, but what I've heard sounds intriguing.
Well, the big deal, it's been sort of in the works, but there's all this kind of pushback, and most of the pushback tends to be from broadcasters.
So, yeah, because they don't want to give it up.
They don't want to give it up, or they claim that, look, you guys say it's going to fit. Well, let's do a little background first. The idea is things are shifting from analog to digital. Digital channels on given, like, say, your over-the-air TV stations, if an area shifts from analog to digital, all those stations can fit in a much narrower bandwidth worth of channels, much narrower frequency range.
And they don't interfere, too, right?
And they interfere a lot less with each other. There's bigger gaps between them. And all these gaps between them and basically the parts of the frequency spectrum that are unused, all of that stuff that's not, like, part of an actual channel is white space. So it's, like, all the in-betweens, basically. And the idea is, when it was analog television, you had to have that specific gap between those two, and you had to keep some blank space in there just for everything to work right, so you wouldn't have crosstalk and things bleeding over into, you know, one channel bleeding into another and all that other stuff going on there. So the idea is that with the shifts to digital and all the other transitions that are happening just with the things just getting more modern, you end up with all this white space. Now, when you flip that over into your wireless router at your house or anything that's like a wireless kind of a technology that your typical consumers are going to use, that is very limited, right? The FCC has been pretty really narrow on what they'll let people use, right? So for your wireless G router, you only get so many channels. Those channels are squeezed in this very small spectrum of 2.4 gigahertz. And really, that's what limits your speed, is how much of that spectrum you have, right? So you get some of these routers, like newer routers will cheat. They'll come up with their own little special things that they do, like they'll actually hop a couple of the wireless channels and use several channels at the same time, and that gives you like these super, you know, twice, three times the bandwidth.
That's where these router companies come up with that ability, if you have matching hardware to run it higher than spec.
Right. And they're still operating within the band that you get. They're just using more of it, right? They're using several channels at the same time. Well, with white space kind of stuff, it's, you have a lot of it, right? If you have the right kind of tuner, that thing can just spread bandwidth over a huge chunk of frequency, right? If the technology has some sort of means of figuring, okay, which things are actually being used in this area, and it just sort of does a smart thing and figures out, okay, is anybody broadcasting on this? No? Okay, this area is not using these TV channels. I'll just use them, right? And then it just sort of just jumps on that stuff, uses it. Well, again, it's low range, right? It's not meant to go really far. It's meant to be sort of a, you know, maybe a neighborhood kind of thing. Not just like your house, but a little bit further, but not really, you know, you're not broadcasting miles away. But the idea is that really high bandwidth, smaller areas, and if there's enough of that frequency to go around, that range to go around, then you could potentially be hopping from like neighborhood to neighborhood, and this could eventually push towards like a mesh sort of possibility, okay. And you're just using extra frequency, right? You're just using stuff that isn't being used otherwise. The holdups on it is because the TV stations and broadcasters and people that like even the people who even claimed, hey, we did our own tests, and if you're using the space between these two channels, it actually is interfering. You know, it actually is causing these really big issues, right? But on the flip side, you get, I think the Microsoft sponsored a test recently. It was within the past few months. They had like a couple of Xboxes, or they did some kind of thing where they were broadcasting like HD streams, and it was going right. Like a pretty decent distance, and it was going through walls and bushes and through backyards and stuff like that, and it was going like I guess across like one side of a neighborhood to another. And if you had just some kind of box you could hook up to your house, and it would just piggyback on that network, you could have like a crazy high-speed bandwidth LAN party just like within your neighborhood, not even using your internet, just, you know, using what's local to you. And then if you tie the internet into that and you just sort of make that into a grid, that's the really big deal. That's like the precipice for this thing where it turns into, wow, there's a lot of, you know, capability there, a lot of possibilities there. But you're probably going to get pushback from all kinds of people, namely internet providers, I hate to say. You know, they get wind that the whole neighborhood can have free Wi-Fi because one guy has, you know, a decent internet pipe hooked up to his house. Right. That's like game over for a lot of people.
David, how do you see this integrating into kind of that distribution model that we were just discussing? Like, how do you see this? I mean, is it just kind of what Alan's saying and kind of frees up everybody to do all these new and interesting things? Or is it more on the, you know, kind of unification of all this internet technology that way?
Well, I think the hope there is, I mean, the reason why this sort of sparked interest in me is because it did remind me of the old days of the ISPs, people sort of buying closets and renting closets and putting modems in there and then giving people access to the internet. This just seems like a great way of providing extremely fast, certainly by our standards, extremely fast, you know, internet and connections to areas. So, I mean, I love the idea of, you know, like my father-in-law's village getting one of these, you know, whatever you would be using to pick it up or whatever technology was required. And basically you can have like one incredibly fast connection to the internet and be sharing that amongst, you know, village. You're wired your village instantly with one, you know, with one installation type thing. So, but even more than that, it's just the idea of, you know, even being able to wire a property, being able to wire, you know, farms, you know, it just all of a sudden, as you say, the potential of basically blanketing the planet in wireless is very appealing to me. I love the idea of being connected all the time. That's just sort of
a necessary step to get the connected life that we all kind of envision and read about in the science fiction novels.
Yeah, right? It's very neuromancer. You know,
I miss party lines. I miss picking up my phone and listening to my neighbor's conversation with their family down about how their son did. Never mind, but
you can still do that because now you'll all be connected on the same network, but you have to do a different type.
But you have to have a really good cryptography software program.
You'll be able to buy those
users. Oh, speaking of which, real quick, it's not in the notes, but that whole wireless protected security, the WPS thing on routers, if you Google that, you'll see that there was recently an exploit and a tool put out. If you have a sticker on your router that has a little passphrase thing and it says WPS, I think it's WPS next to it, and this is not WPA or WPA2, nothing to do with that. This is a means of like just establishing the connection with your router. Some companies just sort of build this in. And they think it's a neat feature to give you. WPS is like exploitable now with a tool. And it can be, you can basically figure out the passphrase within, I think it's roughly a 24-hour period. And so it doesn't matter if you're using WPA2, rotating key, all kinds of crazy, you know, this is Fort Knox, no one's getting in. Guess what? They can figure out the key within like a day with this. So if you have this WPS thing on your router, go in your firmware, try to figure out how to disable it.
If it's a Linksys router. This is why we need faster and faster computing technology, so we can figure out these types of things quicker and quicker. What was they were using GPUs for?
So you'd be faster breaking the code on that?
This isn't
even that hard to crack, really. I mean, this is just, I don't even think it's a GPU accelerated tool. It's just a really generic tool. It's like within 18 to 24 hours, you're in. You got the key. It's
be wary of cars sitting outside your driveway, I guess, with their laptops out.
Yeah, if you have a Linksys router, I've researched this a little bit. Most of the Linksys routers, like, there's no way to turn the feature off, unfortunately. So the solution there is, I will just state that the DDWRT aftermarket firmware, the open source firmware, does not even support that feature. So people have complained that it doesn't support it in the past. Guess what? It's now a bonus to you that it doesn't support that feature. So, yep, there it is right there on the stream. Open
Bone
source tool for
ass. Wi-Fi.
Well, your key is not safe.
Let's.
See, that stuff terrifies me. I mean, that's just
really
not that I have absolutely anything interesting to steal, but just the idea of, you know, the idea of people being able to get in and just root around and look. I mean, because I personally would love to do that in many cases, but you know, but it just that's the only. I mean, that's the thing that is so terrifying about the wired world now. It's just there's so many exploits. I mean, like every day there's something. You know.
Yeah,
I feel so exploited. But you know what? It's the most attention I've gotten in years.
So we teased it earlier. We were talking about hard drive density and lasers, or frickin' lasers.
Frickin' lasers.
Mentioned earlier. And this is not on sharks. Unfortunately, I don't think there's no sharks involved in this. Is there?
That would make it so much cooler. But no sadly. Okay. So
how do we get better hard drives through use of lasers and... I don't know.
All right, so laser beams.
So
this
in
is
the
pretty
past,
cool. I got to say, I was very, very impressed with this. I love the test results. Watching where they've got the little images of them flipping of the poles flipping.
Yep.
It's very cool.
So in the past, okay, you have companies all the time. They're trying to figure out how do you squeeze more density onto magnetic media. Especially this push was going on before SSDs came out, and even now, probably even more so because they're just looking, they're struggling for ways to compete, right? There was a TDK related, like they researched this tech way back in the day, which was, hey, you could use a laser to heat up the surface a little bit just before you go to write to it. And then that let them make the magnetic fields a little bit narrower, like the space that you were actually manipulating with the field a little bit narrower. But that is nowhere near the same as this. This is completely different. This is, they basically set up a surface with these really small, they call them like nano islands or something, and it's just the magnetic material, and it's magnetized a certain way. And
that's it. I love this diagram.
And
it's just the coolest.
And the way it's set up is that the only way that you change the state of the bit, the magnetic field, is by hitting it with a femtosecond laser. So a femtosecond laser is like super tiny time frame laser. It's like a really short pulse laser. So what they do is, if you take a magnet and you heat it up, what happens? It's like not magnetized anymore, right? It loses its magnetism if you get a magnet too hot. That's one way to demagnetize one. What they're doing is they're sort of catching it like at a resonance. So if you think about like a rubber band stretched out, if you were to let it go, there's a point in time where it snapped the other way initially, right? Just if you're able to freeze frame it. That's sort of what happens here. They time the laser pulse just long enough so that they make it so that, okay, the magnetism is about to just like completely collapse on itself. But they catch it collapses, and it flips back the other way. And then that's where the heat source is gone. And it basically...
Okay, here's the big problem with that. David tried that once and blew up some planets.
I know, right? It's just, so, but these guys figured it out. So it's actually pretty cool. But what's interesting is, I mean, you could just keep hitting the same spot, and every time you hit it, it just flips the bit back the other way. But the challenge is here is this is nowhere near like a production ready thing. This is they figured out how to do it. They did it in a lab. It's cool. That's great. But first of all, these things are so small potentially that we don't even have a good way to read them yet. Mm. Right? Because the magnetic head that we used to use is like orders of magnitude larger than these little tiny dots that they're able to manipulate now. So how the heck are you going to read it? So they're probably going to have to figure out something where actually similar to the method they use to take these photos, because it's actually potentially going to become an optical thing to read it, as opposed to, you know, you have some kind of substance that reacts optically to the magnetic field, and then now you can zoom in on that, you know, with a good enough lens and figure out, okay, now you're actually reading it optically. Probably some kind of polarization.
Can you keep
thing.
Flipping them though? Like, I mean, your analogy there, at some point you're going to run out of power there, right? You're not going to be able to flip it. Does not come into play?
No, that's the thing, because the way the domains line back up once it's on its way to flipping the other way, it basically just, the strength is, from what I've read, the strength is roughly equivalent. Like, it doesn't really diminish. It just constantly
so it snaps back into place in the opposite position every time. See, yep. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, and so the reflection is different. It's not like phosphor persistence in a monitor where you have to have an energy, you know, some energy that's getting that phosphor to glow. You change it at a small enough level, you're going to get a difference in reflectivity.
Yeah, and realize the laser itself is adding energy to this. So that's sort of what, you know, you're putting energy into it. So it's not that it's necessarily going to diminish down to zero if you keep doing it.
Oh, that's true. The pulse itself, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, the pulse itself is what causes some of that flux, that change to happen in this material. So there's
still,
you know,
love this technology because it uses both nano islands and freaking lasers. I mean, then you really won't got me there. You know, if you've got between that, you had me at nano islands.
I think scientists saw our podcast coming because this just hit the press like this morning. So,
oh, did it really? Oh, great.
Yeah,
that was the article that really actually got me on the site. Was I was like, wow, that completely had me excited for some reason. I'm gonna be in the kitchen heating up magnets and stuff.
Don't blow anything
probably,
up.
Probably burning the house down too. Actually, Dad, why doesn't this stick anymore?
I don't want us to be responsible for that. Any personal damage or life changing events.
Doing? I just frying up some magnets, honey. Just frying up magnets.
What do we got next?
So something else interesting that came up was apparently the title here is academic collaboration leads to CPU GPU collaboration, which I guess is kind of ironic in its own way. So this is a paper over at North Carolina State University about using an AMD APU with and improving performance by almost as much as actually more than 20% without overclocking the cores at all. Josh, you have any details on this, on what they actually did and able to get this to happen? And then why didn't AMD do it first?
Well, one, I need to clear my throat. Two, I don't know why AMD didn't do it because the workloads that we're looking at is something that can be done by GPU and CPU, especially when you talk about floating point type applications. Now, apparently they've done some software things, low level stuff that has improved the performance of the CPU by 20% in quite a few workloads. They don't really tell us what workloads they are, but if they're able to get a hold of, say, OpenCL, really dig into it and say, hey, you know what? Photoshop does a bunch of things. We can record what some of the calls are to the CPU. And if we could do a low-level program that runs on the CPU where it can shunt stuff from either, you know, the integer units of the CPU and the floating point, and if it makes more sense, we can shunt that over to the GPU, which, you know, on the AMD Fusion processors right now has, you know, really super high bandwidth and is also, you know, pretty well connected in terms of, you know, control processes, that they can have a pretty significant increase in overall performance because, you know, let me tell you, this GPU on the A8 series it's pretty robust. I mean, it's beefy. It can do a teraflop of single, what is it?
It's 32
Help
bit,
me right? out here, brother. Single
precision?
Not, single precision.
Single precision. Full,
yeah,
full
thanks
point,
for helping
right?
me out, guys. You know, you're
hey,
really...
No problem. We would leave you hanging for just a little
reeling
bit.
Me in there.
David,
you're giving
David,
me
help
hand.
Us out,
you're,
man. Anytime
just
now.
So throwing out that life vest.
It's just so fun watching.
Single stinking you know, precision ops.
Yeah.
It can do really fast. And it can do a lot of them. And so if they were able to really intelligently divide the work up in a lot of these applications, the GPU can do great things, but it takes a lot of manpower to be able to, you know, program these things to be able to utilize,
the different hardware.
Well, I'm
killing myself here.
No, no, it's.
I mean,
no,
just put a gun up to my head.
Like, this is just like the homogenization of CPU, GPU, right? It's treating the GPU
heterogeneousness.
As a set of pipelines.
It is. But what's interesting about what this paper did is they said they were able to improve performance by over 20% in the same process without overclocking, just by changing the way they work. So they say specifically they changed the way the L2 prefetch is utilized. Increasing memory access to that level frees up more of the L3 to pass the data between the CPU and GPU. Now, that is that kind of shared cache is what allows the two processor types, the SIMD units and the standard
x86. That's strange because Llano does not have any L3 cache. But I can see better sharing of L2 cache through the memory controller and the crossbar in between the CPU and the GPU. So, workloads that are more appropriate for, you know, the floating point type applications and the capabilities of the GPU would be great at that. But again, we don't have all the details of this. We don't see, I mean, it's not going to help you in Word. I mean, this all this integer stuff, I mean, it's all going to be total CPU and is going to be more memory dependent than the kind of workload, say, you know, you're applying a filter in Photoshop. I mean, that's going to be all floating point. It's going to be heavy-duty calculations, you know, balancing out the colors, brightness, whatever, of each individual pixel. I mean, that's a lot of work. So, I hope that AMD contacts them and say, hey, give us your secret sauce, because we need it.
Right.
It just seems strange that they wouldn't have come up with this.
I think one of the keys is Josh is saying it's very specific workloads, right? And that could be the key here is AMD's, you know, Llano is still made for a general purpose type computing environment. And it kind of makes sense that in one instance, doing some very specialized workloads using very specialized CPU tweaks, they'd be able to kind of eke this extra percentage out. And we just hope that maybe it's applicable to more workloads in that way. So, one of the things that AMD did mention at the analyst day, they didn't use the word Ultrabook. It's an Intel copyrighted name or trademark name. And but they did mention that they were planning on doing, they actually showed reference ultra thin notebook based on Trinity, which is the next CPU after Llano, the next APU after Llano that combines CPU and GPU resources in a single part, which kind of got us thinking, right? So David was talking about his MacBook Air earlier. Intel was all about Ultrabooks at CES. They were. If you didn't see an Ultrabook, then you weren't at CES. And AMD is going after that same market without necessarily saying they're going after the same market. They don't want to be the follower. They want to still try to say that they're doing things different. They're going to offer it at lower price points, that type of thing. Got us thinking, you know, about how important or how easily adopted these types of devices are going to be. The kind of ultra-thin notebooks like the MacBook Air and the Ultrabooks from Intel and tablet devices as well. I don't know. David, your thoughts on kind of consumer consumption devices versus consumer creation devices. Do you consider your MacBook Air a creation device, or do you really see it mostly as a consumption device?
The MacBook Air is definitely for getting things done. I mean, the iPad that I have is completely just for consuming. It's a little bit frustrating. I mean, frustrating. I love it as well. It's also sad because, you know, my wife and I now go to bed, you know, put in our mouth guards and each watch something different on our iPads at night. I mean, it's very sexy.
Yeah.
The MacBook Air, I'm amazed at how it's basically taken over. It is now my machine for just about everything. I have, you know, I have the iMac that I use for editing and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I still believe that that's what's going to happen with, you know, with people like me, at least for the time being. You do need the big desktop system for getting the editing done and stuff. I mean, yes, you can sort of get by on these MacBook Airs and such, but I think for the most part, if you're really seriously doing any editing and stuff, you want a grounded system that's, you know, it's the with all the available ports and everything.
What are you casting on right now? I'm curious.
This is my iMac. Yeah.
Okay. And that's just, it's probably a convenience issue for you right there. Camera's at the right height.
Yeah, camera's the right height. The laptop has all my stuff on it. That's where I'll reference everything from there. Like, that has all my email. It has, you know, it's with me all the time, basically. I mean, I would love it if my iPad was a little better at that. I mean, you know, I in an ideal world, you know, like in Atlantis, basically. Atlantis, one of the funny things they used to do in Atlantis is they used to always give me these tablets with pens. And I would pull the pens off and say that there's no way in the future we're going to be using pens. There's just no IQ. So the poor.
That'll be the case, huh?
They were all Dells. Come on, man. Dells.
It used to drive me crazy. I mean, look, you're talking to someone who had the original Newton. Like, I was so into the idea.
Oh, you were the one.
Yeah, I bought it. The butt warmer. It's so hot. You used to basically put it in your back pocket and it would just keep you warm on a Toronto evening. But you know, I think there's still a distinction. I mean, there's still the MacBook Air isn't designed to be your only computer. And I mean, I'm using MacBook Air it's a brand to me. They're all the same. And they're not all the same, but the point being is that it's just a nice thin laptop, basically, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, there's always got to be some kind of a trade-off with that. I don't think I doubt in my lifetime are we going to be able to do everything on these little things that you can do on the desktops. So,
Josh had linked an interesting article here in the Wall Street Journal about using tablets in schools. Do you think, you know, I was when Kindles first came out and then the iPad first came out and they were talking about using these ideas for textbooks. Do you think that is the future? Is that everything will move to that? Do you think it'll still be a mix?
Absolutely. I would hope that my son, by the time he's actually doing any sort of, you know, real learning, is going to be using the tablets. Because, I mean, the textbooks just allow you to do so much more. So if we had the textbooks that you can get now, I was looking at the iBook stuff the other day, just as an example. But, you know, these interactive textbooks where you've got, you know, actual animations that show you stuff instead of diagrams, where there's lectures, there's all sorts of stuff available for you. I mean, as a learning tool, the iPad is absolutely amazing. My kid has learned so much using that, and he started on the iPhone, basically, but the iPad just sort of took over. I mean, I don't even read books anymore. I love books, but I just don't see the point. It's just much easier, it's just much easier to use on the iPad now. Or the Kindle. I love the Kindle as well, but it just doesn't make sense to have both.
Yeah, you know, as a college student, when I first went into the Boston University bookstore and picked out the books that I wanted, and I laid them all down there, and they started coming out as $120 a piece, and I had to buy six of them.
It's insane.
I would rather buy a $499 tablet and then do $15 a copy of whatever. I mean, sure, the initial put-down price for tablet, yeah, why not? I mean, you know, most of the money is spent on the actual production of these books.
The textbook market is going to be just like the movie market and the music market. They're not going to want to give that up.
Well, they're not going to want to give it up.
They're going to fight it too.
I don't think they're going to have a choice because the tools are getting dang cheap, pretty fast, to the point where you can have a lot of competition as far as who's making these references, right? You know, think of just podcasting stuff in general, right? This podcast is pretty stinking high quality compared to like what you might have years ago, right? So you're going to have people, just average Joe, come up with, you know, somebody that has a really good degree in something comes up with some specialized book, and a bunch of professors just go, hey, this book's really great for this. They just start using that. The guy's only selling it for $5. So, you know.
Yeah, or build your own books. I mean, made out of links, made out of, you know, wiki pages, made out of, you know, whatever's available. I mean, I think the other thing is, one of the things they were talking about with textbooks is the fact that every year they could put out new editions, that there's also a whole huge market for selling used textbooks as well. And a lot of the students prefer to buy textbooks, apparently, because then at least they can recoup some of their costs by selling them later, which you can't do with the electronic versions. So again, like you say, with the movie industry, with the television, it's, you know, costs are going to come down. You know, it's got to become widely available to everybody, and it's got to become cheap enough for people to want to pay for it. You know, I think you're going to see, instead of buying a textbook, you're going to subscribe. You'll just, you know, the school have a subscription to whatever you know, information that they need in some kind of a book format for the iPad, and you'll subscribe for it to it as long as you need to be taking the course. And as soon as you stop taking the course, you can either choose to continue or let it expire.
Now, the one thing that does need to happen, and being the father of two school-aged children, is these tablets need to be a whole lot tougher than they are now. You drop a frickin' iPad on its corner, and you shatter the glass.
Although,
how many times have you seen 4-year-old kids picking their nose, doing things, dropping on the ground?
I got a case that's actually amazing. I can't actually reach it without leaving, but I got a fantastic like armored case, but it defeats the purpose to me, because same thing with the iPhone. I have the beautiful little iPhone, whatever it is, and you have to put these bloody rubber cases around them, and they're suddenly 5 times the size they were when you bought them. It's like they don't need to actually make them smaller. They just need to add some rubber to them, and you know.
Yeah. It kind of ruins the whole sleekness and sexiness of your device, and you wrap it 7 times and
just like giant rubber condoms.
Because I'm all about sexy and wrapping it 7 times.
You are that I know you are, Josh.
Yeah. There's an image I wanted.
Yes.
Yeah, we get that a lot from Josh.
This is our show. Sorry. So let's talk. We did have one other bit of news we wanted to mention here. NVIDIA Kepler graphics card lineup leaked to the web. We wanted to mention this. This was kind of interesting news. This is the next generation GPU from NVIDIA. Finally moving past Fermi onto to something else. Obviously, AMD came out with their 7000 series of graphics cards starting in late December, released actually for sale in early January. And NVIDIA, I think it's fairly obvious at this point, has pulled up its schedule, right? I don't think we would have seen these at the time frames that this rumor states they're going to be at had it not been for the pressure from AMD, which is one of those cases where we say, hey, competition is good. And without AMD really pushing the CPU market anymore, which we kind of theorize is going to happen, it makes me a little bit cautious on how CPU performance might increase in the coming years. But regardless of that, back to the Kepler lineup, is there anything that really stands out to you here, Josh, in particular with these release dates, clock speeds, shader counts, those types of things?
Yeah, it actually kind of does, because... For the past couple of years, we've seen NVIDIA release larger chips with more capabilities, but it costs a lot more for their partners. It costs a lot more to produce. They're often several months later than the competition. And even though they offer, you know, fairly comparable levels of performance, the price is often significantly larger. I mean, we're talking 20 to 25% larger die size for each chip. More complexity. Sometimes yields and bins are not as copacetic as they want them to be. So in the end, that causes consumers to pay more money for these products. But it appears for this generation that NVIDIA's kind of pulled an AMD in that they've gone back, they've really redesigned a lot of stuff. And I know that's kind of a technical term for y'all. But they have smaller die size. They have lower power draw, but we're going to see performance that is as good, if not a little bit better, per millimeter squared die size than what AMD is able to produce with their 7900 series, which that is something that nobody was really expecting, because NVIDIA, they've made it bigger. They don't care about die size as much. They just want the best product on the market, and somehow they've gone back. They've re-engineered a lot of stuff, and they're going to have products that look to be as good, if not better, than what AMD has to offer right now, and they can offer it cheaper. So this could be kind of what, a couple of years ago, what AMD did to NVIDIA. I mean, if you remember the HD 4800 series, they offered them at much lower price than what NVIDIA did, even though they offered about 95% performance of what the higher-end product. But, I mean, they pulled less power. They were cheaper, and they did just as much stuff, except, of course, GPU, not as well. But still, overall, the quality product that was given to consumers was as good, if not better, than what NVIDIA had to offer. And their software, you know, had
gotten up to the point where they were comparable to what NVIDIA was able to give. So now we're seeing NVIDIA, from all indications, doing to them what AMD had done to NVIDIA. So we're going to see some really interesting fights come the spring once NVIDIA finally releases their products. Even Charlie from Semi-Accurate is somewhat bullish on what NVIDIA is able to, is going to be able to do. So it's going to be a lot of fun to see, and I think it's really going to shake up the market between what the two companies are doing.
A couple of the specifics here. For those interested, the rumors are saying the GTX 680, so the single fastest single GPU graphics card, would be a 550 square millimeter die, 850 megahertz clock speed, with 1,024 stream processors, essentially twice as many as the GTX 580 has today. 512-bit memory bus would also be pretty impressive, 2-gig frame buffer. But a $649 price tag is not
too
a
high.
Welcome sight. Yeah, much I mean, high. Well, this is one of the things that happens, right? And AMD released their 7970 at 550, and the market hasn't really shifted down any. So hopefully, if the rumored April release timeframe is correct, we will see a market shift of some kind that will then kind of bring that price down. You know, the rumor claims about 45% better performance than the HD 7970. So we're seeing really big leaps and jumps here, going from the 580 to the 7970 to the 680, which is really impressive. But I would also like to see those accompanying jumps in step with lower prices as well.
So, okay, David, I've got to ask you, when was the last time that you replaced a video card in one of your machines?
It's got to be, it's probably
a decade.
15 years, something like that.
Yeah. You're a bad, bad man.
I know. But you know, well, it's funny. It's one of those, it's like one of those hobbies that had to sort of get pushed by the wayside because I
subsumed by other.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I was just acting, it was great because I could play with the computers and I had lots of time to pull things apart and build things and money to do it. You know, as the years have gone by, I found myself doing more writing and more sort of creating my own stuff. So that sort of means that you can't really have your computer's guts hanging out when you come to the desk to get something done. So
I do find that my own personal computer is the one that is upgraded the least frequently because it is the one that I depend on every day to write on, to work on, to do all the stuff that we do on the site. And instead, we're pretty fortunate in the business we are that we have extra PCs just sitting around with the sole purpose of being torn apart and put back together and tested and evaluated.
Yeah, I used to have a couple. I used to have like three systems and I would play with. I'd have like the one that was that would sort of stay, the sort of the dull, boring one that basically made sure that everything worked properly. And then I had a couple of other sort of chassis that I would play with. So
I think the last thing we're going to mention here today is a little short video of it's already kind of an outdated video of the new PC Perspective offices that we are building here in Kentucky, actually. And you can see a little video walkthrough of it. Nothing really exciting to look at yet, but it's exciting for us moving from a much, much smaller place to a much, much larger place. You can see kind of a video walkthrough of where it is. Lights hanging down, network cables all over the place, no ceiling tiles, and apparently a Franklin Savings sign on the door.
Nice.
From the owner as well. But I'll still a no soliciting sign, which I'm definitely going to keep on there as well. So it's interesting for us. We're hoping to do a lot more kind of creative and interesting things in terms of video, a lot more live stuff as opposed to only pre-recorded stuff because we'll have more room to have multiple sets arranged and we'll have all kinds of things connected, lots more room for more cameras, room for more lights, that type of thing. So it's pretty interesting. It's an exciting time for us. It's a dangerous time for us, spending a lot of money, that type of thing. So it should be cool, though. It should be fun.
It is amazing, you guys. But what's beautiful about this stuff is that you guys are on the crest of the wave. You know, you guys are starting. You're doing this before it's becoming mainstream, and I think that's what's so exciting about it.
We talked about earlier about what Leo has done in the Twit Network and how they have grown from a single bedroom to one level of a house to two levels of a house, and now they built this huge multi-million-dollar studio setup that is impressive as hell when you're inside of it. And it really shows you what you can do with. It's still a lot of money to me as a single person, as an entrepreneur, right? But in terms of, yeah, we got one guy sitting there.
Look at the size of that green screen.
When you've got one
my
guy.
People, look at my wingspan.
You can do so much with so little compared to what it took just less than 10 years ago, right? You know, Leo likes to talk about all the time.
$1 million will get you what $35 million would 15 years ago.
Maybe even bigger ratio than that.
But, yeah.
They talk about how much it costs to run tech TV, and how they're doing better content than that for way less money today on the network as it is. So we're hoping to do something. You know, we're not gonna have near as many shows as that. Gosh, Ken would have to drop out of school. It would be horrible life for us here. We don't want to do that. But we're gonna do some interesting, some fun things, and mix it up. And David, you are welcome back anytime on anything we do, PC Perspective Podcast or any of the other shows that we kind of create and work with on the way to wherever we're going. So,
oh, thank you very much. It's been it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for tracking me down and allowing me to sort of geek out with you on this stuff. I've got obviously have a lot to learn.
Hey, we'll get you building your own your new PC here pretty soon. You got to get you play some PC games, move out that way. Get
there you go. Well, there's your first additional show. It can be you know watch the actor moron try to build a computer after 20 years.
I see ratings through the roof.
You know,
hey, you
could come in with.
Hey,
all
you know what?
Really
your kid's
props.
Gonna start saying, "Hey, I want to play some MMOs, Dad." You're like, "Well, let me build some computers for you."
We'll have David on a podcast. He'll have his PC on its side open. He'll be like installing stuff. We'll be like trying to tell him how to put it in there, and then he'll just like bust out like a ZPM prop
out
of nowhere and just
powered.
Like,
ZPM
stick it in there.
Powered. Exactly. Like, in fact, it would be kind of nice to have something Atlantis-like in its design, perhaps. I could mod myself some kind of Atlantis style.
Case mods, absolutely. There you go.
Look at that. I think I still have it somewhere.
All right, so let's finish up with hardware, software pick of the week here.
Sweet.
This is where we just run through a couple of things that we're suggesting. I came across this today, and I thought this is the perfect thing with Valentine's Day coming up, where you need to build that computer for your wife or your girlfriend. So surely there's out there. Or both. Buy two, ship them to different locations, whatever it is you want to do. So here's a bright friggin' pink NZXT Phantom case. And I mean really bright pink. I think we saw this at Computex last year or last... thought they were going to sell it. They were debating whether or not it would be beneficial in the market. And I was like, sure, why not? You know, I mean, we've got every
The only
color.
Thing better for that would if you could do some fake fur on that. A pink fake fur fuzzy case.
You can do that. You know, because I think we had an email, or maybe it was a voicemail several months ago that was very specific about, hey, I'm a girl. I like the color pink. I play games. What kind of case we have? And there weren't a whole lot of options. I think this is a pretty new option out there. It's a really high-end case in terms of features and quality and that kind of stuff, too. It just happens to be really, really pink. And it's $109, $110 on Newegg, pretty reasonably
That's
priced as well.
Not bad at all.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's... nice case. The NZXT Phantom series is pretty good. So if you like bubblegum or princesses, this is the case for you.
Yeah, I'm all behind both of those things. Sometimes with sticky results, but yeah.
Yeah.
You little bubblegum princess, you.
Josh, what do you got lined up for us?
What do I have? Well, since Jeremy's not here, it's me. My wife had all kinds of locking issues, and it wasn't just because of my sense of humor. And so I finally replaced the power supply on her computer, and everything cleared up, even the rash. Corsair makes a pretty darn good power supply. And if I could talk as any more of a hick, I would certainly attempt to do so. But anyway, 750 watts, $104, you know, right off the bat. If you want to, you know, send in one of those instant rebates, it's like $89. Some money's well spent because the lack of amount of complaining I've had to deal with for the past week has been fantastic for my, well...
Oh, hey.
For my soul and center.
interesting point on that power supply, Josh. Previously, I think the biggest you could get in that specific size from the Corsair was a 680. So this is new, and if you're one of those people that has the smallest possible power supply form factor in your case,
and you know what, I'm all about having the smallest possible things because I just can't help it. I was born that way.
So, you know, if you need more power out of the power supply, but you still have like a really cramped setup, that should just drop right in, and it's 750 watts, so that's pretty good.
Super. Yep. So take that, Corsair. Make nice power supplies. Make my wife happy. Worth its weight in gold.
Alan, next up.
Actually, I have a pick that's, believe it or not, might apply very well to David as well. Sort of killing multiple birds with a stone here. So we were at a CES in Vegas a month ago now-ish or so, right? And we were at a Storage Visions conference, and we came across these guys that had that make this thing called the IOSafe. Input-output safe, IOSafe. Basically, it's a hard drive. It's in a really beefy enclosure. But here's the catch. The materials that are inside this enclosure are the same kind of thin materials that are inside your fireproof safes that you can get for your house. You know, the little really thick plastic, consumable, burnable material safe that you put like your important documents in or whatnot and you close it up. Well, this is, the hard drive is inside, and I actually have one here. They sent one. We're reviewing it. And we'll write this up pretty soon. But it's just, you know, it's pretty hefty. I mean, the thing is heavy.
Those are heavy.
And it's just...
And it's bigger than a bread box.
Well, okay, so it has, first of all, to go along with the safe thing, it actually has some, you know, mounting holes. You can bolt this to, like, the floor of your closet or whatnot. It has USB 2 and external serial ATA connectors on it. And the idea is there's only one hard drive in there. It's not a RAID or anything. But it's wrapped, it's completely surrounded by this consumable, you know, material. And the hard drive itself is wrapped in a special foil wrapper as well. So the thing is, like, it's, okay, so here's what you could do. You could subject it to, like, something like 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit or something for a half an hour. So the idea is you have a house fire and this thing
send
just
send it
of,
to the sun.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So basically it's under... You know, Alan's bed for, you know.
So not only can it withstand that, but with the wrapper that's the hard drive is in and everything, it's rated for like 10 feet submerged in water for like some amount of time as well. So basically you could have water mains bust, all this stuff happen, your house burns down. So the reason that something like this applies to David specifically is you might have like something you're working on at your house, right? Like some kind of footage. Something.
Oh, see, that's a test I want to do. I was hoping to do that.
Ken so, suggests thermite.
Take so, that hard drive.
So I mean,
sweet.
While there might be cloud based solutions that you can upload a few gigabytes of something to the cloud, and it's only as practical as your bandwidth is to get it up there as you're messing with it, right? If you're editing a bunch of video footage or some kind of vital something, and you want it to be. You don't want to send it out anywhere. It's like unreleased footage, something like that. You want it to be secure, but you know, you have what happens if your house burns down, right? Well, these are the first guys that I've seen make something like this that, you know, they've got the thing sitting in a bucket of they're just like submerging in water. And
how funny would it be though if it survived like a house fire and then being hit by a hose and then your hard drive crashes?
Drop it out of the bucket, if you know what I mean.
Well, okay, actually, they do have the hard drive crashed part covered as well because they've contracted out with one of the hard drive recovery places, the ones that actually open up the drive and move the platters and stuff like that. So basically, if this, you know, the fire happens, the footing happens, whatever happens, and then you can't manage to get it back up, then they will just, like, no questions asked. It's covered for like 10 years or something. It's, you know, some amount of years, or it might even be a lifetime. And you just, like, send it out and they'll just... They're dropping it from like 20
I just love
feet.
Just watching it being dropped.
Don't
by
they?
It.
Don't they run this over too?
Yeah, but they ran it over. With
can they
like,
get it back up? If you know what I mean.
Yeah, look.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I mean, they're just going to town on this thing and messing it up. They actually have a portable solid state drive based one as well, and they did this test of it by, you know, the Tesla coil chamber. You know, where you have like the guy in the metal suit and he's holding up a, you know, he holds whatever and like arcs are flying and hitting his metal suit and everything. They took like one of those and they just like zapped the thing to death. And the enclosure, like the interface on the enclosure didn't work anymore, but they took the SSD out from the inside of it, and that, you know, connected to the PC just fine, and they got the data back. So, yeah,
if
these
this
guys take this
to my
seriously.
Hard drive, that would be the least of my concerns, I think. But if, look, if my house was on fire and then underwater
and bulldozed
and crushed by something, then yeah. I think the least of my concern is like, are my photos backed up?
Godzilla comes to your neighborhood. Don't worry,
David. What if you had like your next film? You know, you were editing a chop of your film on it, right?
No, I love it. I'm actually only joking because I think it's, you know, that's one of the big issues you have is archiving stuff, right? So that would be for that kind of stuff. You totally, that's perfect for that.
Yep, and it's I think it's like a 1, 2, and 3 terabyte capacities, just because, you know, those are the easy capacities that are out right now. The prices.
What does it cost? What's it going for?
So they sort of bounce around depending on which one you want. They have models with different kinds of connection speeds, different, you know, USB 2 or external serial ATA or USB 3, that kind of thing. But they range from the one that I just held up here, which is USB 2 and external serial ATA combined. It starts at $350, I believe, for the 1 terabyte model, and then it just sort of goes up by like a $100 increment every time you add another terabyte.
$350. Even after the Thailand flooding that it was sent 1 terabyte drives to $300?
Actually, before the Thailand flooding, these things were, they started at $250, I believe. And they had to up it just because of that, because of the flooding issues. But, you know, that'll hopefully come back down and whatnot. But, yeah, I mean, this is a really, this is for that kind of security for your storage. Now, again, you still want to back stuff up, but this is definitely the ideal sort of backup thing where you want to keep the backup in your house and you don't want anything to happen to the backup, right?
Well, especially with so many home offices too. I mean, there's so many people live at home and it's working from home that it's right. You know, it is going to become more and more of an issue for people.
Yeah, if you have your backup and your backup is sitting right next to your PC and it's not in something that's fireproof,
what are you talking about?
I
think I just kicked my backup over.
Oh.
Oops.
Awesome.
Damn.
All right, David, don't put you on the spot here. Do you have a hardware or software pick?
I'm not sure this is exactly a surprise to anybody this week, but the thing that I'm so enamored with right now is these Samsung flexible screens, because I've just sat on so many cell phones in my life that just seems like the answer to all of my prayers. You know, this beautiful flexible Samsung. What are they? I'm not sure what the exact term for it is. OLEDs.
AMOLED.
What are they called? Flexible.
Just AMOLED.
AMOLED.
Yep.
I'm not sure. Right, they haven't really quite got them yet for me. They still look a little bit like a tissue dispenser right now. But it's I think it's sort of one of those things that in the future is going to be very. Be very useful for us. Their ad is very funny. There's a great ad where this guy walks around with like this is a little flexible piece of glass and does all these wonderful things with it. But when you actually see the models, you know, in action, you know, they still have to be attached to something. So they're these beautiful little flexible screens attached to a big clunky, you know, controller of some sort. But still, it just seems it's just the idea of. And you can, you know, you can smack them with hammers and stuff. They're because they're so flat. It's basically a, you know, it's just like a sheet of plastic, basically. And the image looks pretty good, I got to say. So that's my
impressive. I'd like to have a whole bunch of that. I mean, even just the thinness of
this
is impressive.
I love this. Yeah, this is it. Because no, I'm just not sure where exactly all the processing's happening.
Well, that's through the mesh network that we already talked about, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, I like how it just made 3D too. That was awesome.
And you can pick up women.
Oh yeah, that's the only reason we make technology. I thought.
Yes, because you know technology.
That's the only reason I buy technology. Are you serious?
I build computers with the sole purpose of picking up chicks with them.
Oh yeah, totally.
That's got to be the reason.
You can see my level of success.
Flaunting it.
Yes.
All right.
Flaunting.
I think that will wrap up the show for us. Again, David, thanks for joining us. It was a blast. Loved having you on.
Pleasure. Thank you very much. I'd love to join you again sometime.
You know, I've got to ask you one more thing, David. 1990 starred with Uma Thurman. Give us some details.
Yes. Where are the heart?
Detail.
That's when I was young and attractive, and actually apparently could pass off as Uma Thurman's older brother, younger brother. I'm not sure what that was. On that. Susie Amos as well, another lovely actress as well. But it was a film called Where the Heart Is. I did for John Boardman all those years ago. Yeah, worth seeing.
And
have
so
a look.
In there with Christopher Plummer, Dabney Coleman, and Uma Thurman. What the hell happened?
It's one of the funnest times of my life. But the movie doesn't quite sort of. It's beautiful. It just doesn't really work as a movie that much.
Doesn't resonate, huh?
It was honestly like one of the best experiences of my life. And working with John Boorman, he's like an amazing director and stuff. But there it was one of his first sort of studio films in a long time, and I think there was a lot of back and forth between Disney and him on that. But it's worth seeing, though. I mean, he did an amazing job with it. So Charlie Boorman.
Sorry, Josh, doesn't sound like you're going to get any juicy details if that's what you're fishing for.
No,
I'm
all about the juice, if you know what I mean.
I don't. And we're gonna say,
I was doing nothing with my life. Thank you very much.
So if you want to get in touch with us or yell at Josh for anything, you can do that in a couple of ways. podcast@pcper.com is the email address, 1-888-38-PCPER, toll-free telephone number in the U.S. and Canada, so David can call, leave messages whenever he wants as well. And if you want to download this podcast, if this is your first time listening or you're just kind of catching on, pcper.com/podcast is the URL you can go. Find all of our previous shows as well as ways to subscribe through iTunes or any RSS reader or anything like that. So we appreciate that. And again, twitter.com/PCPer is where you can find all of our work. David is at twitter.com/DHewlett, right?
That's right. Yep.
And you should be sure to check out his projects. I think there's one episode right now of Assassinate, and I think you can get that at youtube.com/Horizon, where the O is a zero.
Horrid.
The first O?
Horrid.
Or both.
Horrid.
Horrid.
Yeah.
Horrid.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
H0RRID. So there.
When's the next one coming?
We're hoping to have one out for Valentine's Day. I believe we've got a Valentine's Day one that we're supposed to shoot this weekend, which will be interesting because we're doing it actually in different cities this time, as opposed to Kate was actually there for the last one. So we're gonna actually try doing this one from separate cities.
Will you be in eye makeup again?
What do I have planned for this one? No eye makeup on this one, although maybe just for you. I should have worn eye makeup today. I would have done it for you.
Hopefully, people would have had to have seen the episode for the reference. Otherwise, maybe been a little frightened.
Check it out. Rack up our numbers. We're trying to sell it to television. So to traditional television after dissing all of that. That's us. That's the lovely and talented Kate.
Good luck.
Yeah.
It was. It's really funny. It was well cut together. I liked it. That was good.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's basically the idea was we couldn't afford to shoot a pilot, so we thought, what's the cheapest possible way of doing it? And it was just to have a Skype conversation between the two characters. So that's basically what we're going with right now until someone decides to give us some money to actually make something legitimate out of it. So someone should make us legitimate.
Very cool. Well, thanks again, David. You know, Josh, yes.
No, go ahead. You know, David, I would happily help you in that, but only if I could talk dirty to your sister.
Wow.
You would not be the first person to have asked that.
Josh, oh, this is Lord. Josh's last episode of the PC Perspective podcast.
Ever.
Ever.
He's actually blushing. Yeah. He actually got a blush out of him. He embarrassed himself on that one, actually. That's amazing.
His whole head just blushes when it happens. Yeah.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
Time to season.
All right, thanks. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week on the PC Perspective podcast. Without Josh. So thanks everybody for listening. See you next week.
Thank you all, even Josh.
Good night.
Bye-bye.